Yeah. Welcome to a bonus edition of the Soulcast with DJ Payne One. Today we're going to be talking about our forthcoming album, our third record together. It's called No God Nor Country, and we are funding it with Kickstarter. At the time of this interview, we're about halfway funded, with a little bit more than 14 days to go before it closes. So if you dig this interview, if you like what we have to say, if you support our music and the general project, please consider signing up at tinyurl.com/No God Nor Country, and you can pre-order the record on vinyl, CD, etc. Every record, every physical copy comes with like a reader with all the lyrics and like inspirations for the songs and texts and shit. So anyway, we're just gonna have a long conversation about this record, about what went into it, kind of where we've been at for the last couple years, what we've been doing, and our hopes for the record. We're DIY artists, we're doing this all on our own, and if this record is funded properly, we can do some shit that we've never been able to do before and hopefully reach more people with our music. So for this interview, we're gonna start the interview off with a new song. It's called Everything Must Go. It's a track that didn't make it onto the album, and the more I listen to it, the more I love it, but for whatever reason we chose not to go with this track. But check it out, and like I said, if you dig this interview and you like what we have to say, you want to support our new album, go to tinyurl.com/No God Nor Country, and you can back us on Kickstarter. And one last thing, as I was mixing this conversation, I noticed that I had some weird mic settings going on that were picking up all the noise in my studio, so apologies for that, but otherwise it's a great talk, and enjoy the conversation. Thank you.
After the 2016 election, a lot of us woke up to some harsh realities. In the aftermath of dark events, I came back to political work with a new sense of urgency. But after a few months of showing up to protest every weekend, I started to burn out. It didn't feel like anything was changing. In fact, maybe things were even getting worse. And it got me thinking, what comes next? Rebel Steps is a podcast about what comes next. You'll hear episodes on letter writing to political prisoners, practicing mutual aid, and creating political art. You'll hear the voices and stories of my community in New York City, spotlighting a range of organizers from the Metropolitan Anarchist Coordinating Council, NYC Books Through Bars, Anarchist Black Cross, Lower Manhattan Food Not Bombs, Brand Workers, and more. I'll walk you through what you can do to start plugging into movements and learning organizing skills step by step. If you've been to a march or two and you're looking to jump in, this podcast is for you. Or if you have friends looking for more, pass it on. Listen at rebelsteps.com, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast.
DJ Payne One. Even these poems must go. Not gonna need them no more. Thanks to you, we are poor. Not for the reasons they are sure. Some race, pick the soil. Where are you when the bombs no more? Fuck a job, fuck the law. Gotta take a new form. Everything must go. Everything must go. Everything must go. From the room to the tomb to the rumors. From the rooms where the truth stay hidden. From the rules that apply to the bottom. Ain't worth shit but the paper they wrote them. Everything must go, we don't need them. We only need to know basis. But the need is the basis. And the base is eroding. They say, who will keep us safe from the murderers and rapists? Who will keep us safe from the killer cops and mass surveillance? Toxic sky and boiling ocean. You are but you ignore for as long as you can. Definition of safety. Definition of hypocrite. Definition of, I wish I could say it's the end of the line for that shit. But it looks like the bad guys gonna keep winning and take us and around us all in a pit. We could stomp our feet till the buildings tumble, Lord knows. Imagine a world with nobody rules. Lessons never learned, real recognize real trouble. Do you wanna live long or ball like the last half hour before they killed Caesar? Where I'm going, I don't need a visa. Not looking for a handout, but it'll take your hands. If you try to choke me, this one's for the dreamers. The ones that didn't die young. Too much hope for an Obama shirt. Stronger together, not talking a dynasty. We've got to leave after 21st century. Man, oh man, there's two men.
man, band, band in the bland USA, where they say take a stand, not a leap, take a sip, never forget who owns the cup, apologies for the things I can never hold, long enough to carry through this cold, 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 you know the code, everything must go, everything must go, every motherfucking thing.
Even these poems must go, not gonna need them no more. Thanks to you, we are poor, not for the reasons they are sure. Sun rays cook the soil, where will you live when the farms no more? Fuck a job, fuck the law, time to take a new form. Everything must go, everything must go, everything must go.
This is for homies who break laws of all sorts, from lockdowns, illegal grow-ups, and looking at 10 years for punching a cop, cause fuck the law.
We have a new album coming out. It's No God Nor Country. I don't know, man. We've been working on it for a long-ass time. I mean, definitely, like, I was realizing, like, I haven't actually spent that long working on an album really since, like, whatever, Selling Live Water or something. So people who are into the music always ask questions like, what's your process like? And I think our process is like kind of funny. So I'd be curious to hear how you describe it.
I don't really know now. I feel like we've kind of streamlined it since our first album. Because, you know, we did... Oh, man. The first album we worked on together was Death Drive. And then right away there was that 2 EP follow-up. So that was kind of like two and a half albums in one. And you came out here to finish it up because that was us kind of figuring out our chemistry and our rhythm. And actually, I just got an email alert that a new mix for the album is in. Shout out to Filthy Broke Records. But this time around, all this crazy stuff happened. So it was a much more drawn out process because before, you know, you didn't have a kid before. This is the fatherhood album. This is the DJ Payne 1 homeowner album. Things are different. So we took our time on this one, and I think that's it's a good and a bad thing because we're getting the tweets, people thinking that we weren't making music together, but we are. It's just it was sitting there and we were working on it, and we had space. This is what's cool about it. We had space to be neurotic about overproducing and overthinking it, and we resisted that urge. So I'm proud of us for that.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the cool thing about like learning our dynamic is like, you know, my dynamic is always like I don't have any control over what I do, if it's good or bad. It's like it's either good or bad or awesome or in the middle, you know? And so if you send a beat at the right time, it's going to inspire me to write. And like it's like the proper, you know what I mean? Like the proper stars are aligned to like some crazy things happening in the world, or like just read a book and then I just get a beat that like conjures a certain emotion. But yeah, like being a dad made it totally different because I work about, I don't know, probably 60% less than I used to. I used to think I have like this life of luxury where I was just like, you know, staring at flowers all day, contemplating the revolution or whatever. And like, well, really, I worked a fucking lot and I just didn't realize it. And then as soon as you have a kid, you realize, oh shit, like every... there's this little human being growing that you have to care for every part of the day, and like you're tired for the first 6 months and like adjusting. So it's like, I feel like what makes this album cool is just like cool snapshots of like the first, you know, being a dad of the first 2 years, and also like what that means, like going from like embracing the pessimism of like global warming and like the Trump era, and like, but then also like fighting that pessimism, kind of like, I mean, much like Nihilismo was responding to a similar thing, but it's a very different thing when you have a kid and you're like, you can't be like, oh, the world's gonna burn. It's like, no, actually, you know, it's like, yes, it's burning, but like, what are you gonna do right now? Like, this kid is, you know, is ready to eat solid food now, you know, and just all the man, being a dad is just such a trip. It's like it's so stressful but so fun. But it also like opens up your empathy. And so it's like I know that now, the same way that like when I would walk around with the dog, you know, and I'd like greet other dog owners, like, oh, we speak the same language. It's like now I'm like more tied into that universal fraternity of parent.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like our process has always been weird because it's like we'll come off tour and like we won't talk. Like we don't like talk on the phone. We're not like, you know, constantly in communication. And so like I'll just randomly get like a zip of beats, you know, and then I'll like open it up and be like, and I've learned to like only listen to one at a time so that like they're always new when I'm like ready to listen to them. And so it's been like, so it's just been an interesting experiment. Like I'll get like five beats from you. I'll open it. I'll like, you know, I'll be like, okay, I have all this shit to do this week, but next week I'm gonna fucking go ham on this paint one shit. And then I'll like play it and I'll be like, oh my God. All right. I got it, you know? Or other times I'm like stressed out and not able to write anything great. And so it's like, I don't know, I was like counting. We had like, I think it's like 23 songs, or we had a lot of fucking songs for this album, and or that we made in this time period. And like, I feel like the only ones we kept are the ones that have like that kind of like, I don't know, spark to them that you can just tell it's like everything's clicking and they're awesome. And so it's like, I think that's like a good way to approach an album is you just make a bunch of shit and then you throw away what doesn't move you.
You know, in our defense, we don't talk to anybody after tour.
No. I talk to my wife, but that's about it. Let's talk about like, since we're talking about the process of the album, let's talk about like the decision to use Kickstarter. So like I was like, oh, this album's so important, you know, like people need to hear this sort of analysis on like a mass scale. And so I really wanted to sign it. You know, I feel like you were kind of indifferent about that, but we're down. Yeah, so I sent it to a bunch of big labels, a bunch of big hip hop and punk labels who will all remain nameless, and no one really wanted to put it out. So, kind of had to pull the trigger and do it ourselves, which is like, you know, the story of our life. But what do you think about like working with labels? Do you think that was like a stupid idea to begin with, or do you think that like the era of using labels in that capacity is like kind of pointless, or like what are your thoughts on that? Because I know you work with labels.
Nah, I really don't work. I mean, I work with labels in a 1099 kind of capacity, but I don't work with labels as a signed artist. I've only really done that once, and I was pretty miserable because when you're used to controlling everything, as stressful as it is, you're still controlling everything. So when you said, yeah, dude, this time we're going to get, this is the album that's going to get released by a label, I'm like, all right, Tim. Because I think the last three, we had that same conversation. We're like, the music is this so good and so timely and so important. You know, a label would be crazy to not want to put this out. And, you know, maybe they are. But they haven't, so our consistency is great. We're consistently getting rejected by labels. And, you know, I look at it like this. All right, so, yeah, Kickstarter album pre-order campaigns kind of suck in the sense that we're sitting there watching the funding progress and we're freaking out and we got to create the infrastructure and, you know, it's extra work once the orders come in. A lot of extra work. But with a label, you can't just go online or get like a text message alert saying, hey, your project is 30% funded. Hey, your project is 40% funded. There's no label on the planet that automatically gives you a notification every time, you know, your account balance changes on your master royalties or something. So in that regard, it's cool because, you know, we still have control over it and we get to own our successes and failures. But of course, we want the label advance, and I guess that's just not in the cards for us. I don't. Yeah, it's funny that you asked me about that. You've worked with more labels than I have. You were on Anacon at first, and then you worked with what was that other label with that put out a bunch of your stuff?
I mean, I worked with More Music. I worked with Mush.
Mush, yeah.
Fake Four.
You were in the heyday of indie label advances. I was not. I was trying to shop the demos to Anacon. So, and I, that's where I stand. You have a way different relationship with indie labels. I'm from the era where, unless it's one of these huge independent labels, you're not getting any kind of money up front.
Well, I mean, the advances I got from Mush were like really small. Anticon never did advances. More Music, I got a really big advance, and then I moved to Europe. in general, the thing that I would like is just like, I don't know if it's like a generational thing or an age thing or like just like learning like what makes me happy or what makes me like psychologically healthy. And it's just like, I know it's not doing online marketing. Like, I used to enjoy it, but now it's like, it's become so demanding, like 24/7, that like, it's just like really not what I signed up for. And I just wish that, like we had the sort of like, you know, label infrastructure to do that stuff, because like having like, it used to be like you'd have to learn a new algorithm or a new program or social media platform like every 2 years, every 4 years, but now it's like every 3 months. It's like, oh, there's this new implementation and they want you to do this now, you got to do this, and you got to use Spotify now, and Spotify has replaced radio, and it's like this era of like, you know, mega monopolies over media. And it just happened. It happens. It didn't happen overnight, but it kind of did, you know?
Yeah.
And it's insane.
Yeah, and there's no transparency either. Any of it. I mean, with the ad stuff, I guess, but you don't really know.
Right, and same with Spotify. It's like,
no, Spotify's the worst. When I say transparency, we're looking at the streaming services dead in the eye. But you know, there hasn't been transparency in the music industry ever. Performance royalties are not transparent. You can't ask those people a direct question. Hey, am I getting paid for every performance? No, not really. Well, why? Well, we can't explain it. It's complicated. So it's always been like that. It's just now applied to way more channels because you have all of these new digital streaming channels and channels of consuming music that weren't there 15 years ago. So we're spreading out our income stream, but we don't understand any of them. We haven't understood our income streams in a while. We understand them as much as we possibly can, so that we don't lose everything. But nobody really knows.
Yeah, it's funny because I never even really looked at like Spotify or anything like that until like the last time I did our accounting, and I was like, oh shit. Whatever, we made some money on Spotify. I was like, that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Like, I was surprised. But again, like, a couple $100 a month isn't like anything to fucking retire off of or write home about. It's like, oh, a couple $100 a month. It's like, I thought it was nothing. It's better than nothing.
You know? Right, yeah.
That's why I like using shit like Kickstarter, because it's like, we can know, like right now I have a baby coming in a couple months. Like, I'm not trying to have us go in debt, you know, $10,000 to put a fucking record out and then like wait, you know, a year for it to recoup, which is like what it's like working with labels. Like, you,
yeah.
And chances are, like, you know, they're artists are used to not getting paid and labels are used to not paying people, and so it's like this shit where like a lot of times if you're working with a label it's fucked up. So it's like, I like to know, like, okay, we don't owe anyone anything, here's our record, we have money to make videos and we can market it the way that we want it marketed to the people we want, and we've done our job. You know, it's like, it's a bunch of extra shit, but it's like, I don't know. I think it's
Yeah, but if we got signed to a label, we'd want to have control over that extra shit. We'd start getting frustrated when the label would tell us, no, we don't use this video guy, or no, your release date is here. And that's the frustrating part. I mean, I'm sure there are labels out there that offer the best of both worlds. They give you the infrastructure and the services, but then they also allow for some kind of creative freedom, or at least a compromise on the marketing input from the artist. But for the most part, I mean, the label that I worked with is one of the largest in the world, so I got lost in that system. So that, not a great example.
Yeah, that was a very frustrating experience, from what I remember. Where, like, yeah, you guys got paid, but then it was like the stuff that you were doing on your own was almost
it was more
impactful than what the label tried to do, which is like also an interesting lesson for artists. Like, at the end of the day, it's all about the relationship that we have with our listeners and like how we're presenting our art, what we're doing, and you know.
No, that's all it is, man. People think that they're gonna get signed to a label and the label's gonna go out and get them fans, and you know, maybe that was true a long time ago to an extent, but not anymore. No.
Well, one thing I'll just—I don't know if you have anything else to say about the Kickstarter, but one thing I will say is, like, anybody who's bought our albums before with Kickstarter, we have these readers, which are like, you know, has the lyrics and then like some excerpted texts, kind of explaining like the more background information, so like what's going into the music. And you know, I know like some of these songs were like inspired by Crime Think texts or various people, and so it's like it's cool to be able to like put all that in a reader. And I've found a really cool place to get books made, so yeah. So you want, if people listening want to get a cool like text accompaniment to our album, like the only way to do that is if you pre-order it. So if you're interested in this record, you know, fucking back us on Kickstarter. We still have, at the time of this interview, we still have about 60% left to raise in about 3 weeks. And while that doesn't seem like a lot, it's actually like, you know,
terrifying.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you have anything else to say about any of that shit before we go on to
the... I mean, yeah, that's another benefit to the Kickstarter. You don't really get that from a label pre-order.
What, a little book?
Or all this. I mean, we have all types of stuff. I mean, we set the levels of the premiums for the pre-order, so... Whatever we want it to be, that's what it is. But I've never seen a label pre-order that had a collaboration option. You know what I'm saying? And we do, so that's the benefit.
Yeah, and for the first time in like 10 years, I'm offering colors on my merchandise. Like, usually it's just white on black. Not this time. We got red on black hoodies and black on charcoal gray t-shirts. I mean, that's, you know, a guy who drinks as much coffee as me and spills as much food on himself as I do, like, putting out t-shirts that have light colors, that's like, that's crazy.
Yeah, you're not wearing it.
Right, I will. I'll have to.
You're gonna wear a colored hoodie.
Oh, I mean, it's a black hoodie with red ink, but I'll wear a gray t-shirt. You know, my new style is I just wear light-colored t-shirts with, like, a button-up shirt over them, open, kind of California style. So it's like...
Collect all the food crumbs and the overspill.
Yeah, so when it gets to look like a bib, I just button that shit up. You know, that's a fucking life hack right there.
Yeah. There you go.
You know, and I get to have a little more style and a little more flair. You know, I need to work on my image. Okay, well, speaking of being messy and eating and getting food everywhere, we've been on a couple tours. How many have we been on? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tours? 6?
I think it's 5. It was going to be 6. And then something came up.
Yeah. Wait. We did the first tour where we had that booking agent that was like an asshole and just booked us fucking shows all over the country, where we had to like rent a car and then fly and rent a car and then fly and then hunt down turntables, and then it wasn't his job to find turntables even though that was in our rider. That was the first tour where we just basically like spent a whole bunch of money on airline tickets. That was, yeah. And then we went to Europe. Then we did Southwestern tour. Yeah, we've done a bunch of tours.
So. Yeah, five. It was five.
So what's been, like, what are, like, so to people who, like, who think, like, oh, touring is the life, you know, it's, like, so, and, like, it's easy to complain, but it's actually, like, I was realizing recently, like, I haven't played a show in, like, a year, and I went and played a show with Chesky in Boston, and, like, you know, you get, you know, it's, like, we haven't done it for a while, and you go and do it, it's, like, oh, I miss this shit, this is like, you know, you get out and like you smell all the wafting, competing scents of like Indian food and Thai food and pizzas as you're like loading up to the venue and hanging out. And it was so funny because like everybody else had just got off like a month long tour and everybody else is all like haggard and tired, and I'm like, you know, fresh chicken. Just bouncing around, just talking shit to everybody, just laughing and having fun, because it was like, oh, I'm not tired at all. But, you know, just seeing that, like, oh, y'all been on the road a month. Like, y'all are fucking exhausted.
Dude, Chesky and Factor and all them stopped by here. And I did... I'm sorry, Chesky. I didn't want to say anything. I'm like, man, you guys look like you've been on the road for a while. And I think they hadn't been. It just does something to you, man. Like, I think it's the tour culture, but he's one of those guys who tours. I mean, we think we tour and grind it out. Nah, nobody tours like him. And I think he changed his process up, where now he's sleeping at hotels and not like under pull-out mattresses. But, you know, good for him. But still, man, he goes on these tours, and when he tells me how long he's on the road for, I can't even believe he's telling me that. I think once you get, like, it won't hit me until the second or third or fourth day on tour that I'm on tour again. And then when it hits me, I instantly get that look, that, oh shit, I'm on tour look. But all that changes the second we hit the stage. I mean, that's the thing, you know. I miss being on the stage, but the only complaint I'll ever have is about logistics. Driving 12 hours to get to a sound check. It's, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's never the interacting with people or the performance element that sucks your soul out of you. That's the part that energizes all of us.
Yeah, waking up in a new city, you know, with getting a fresh cup of coffee, you know. I love, yeah. Lately, I just realized it was like the smells. You know, I was like, oh, it's like the smells of like all these different downtown places. But yeah. Yeah, I know. I didn't realize it until you and I were on tour together, where I was like, man, because I wasn't smoking as much weed, because you don't smoke weed, unfortunately, or fortunately. And I was like, because when you're not high the whole time, you realize, like, wow, this is a long time in a car. And the thing is like, yeah, even if you switch that out for flights, it's like, it's almost easier just to go on a 10-hour drive than, like, the stress of, like, getting to the airport and, like, making sure you have, like, the right amount of bags so that, like, you're not getting charged $200 for, you know, your bag that you brought, or like, even if it's only an hour flight, like the amount of bullshit involved with like getting to an airport and getting checked in, it's like sometimes it's better to just take the 6-hour drive.
Well, the fortunate thing for us is we combine the 10-hour drives with the stressful flights.
That's right. What's been like, what are like your favorite like from all of our travels and our touring, like what are your favorite standout experiences or shows or moments from those?
My favorite moments I had just from a tour were probably the first European tour, because that was my first time in Western Europe, and just going to, I thought we were going to be, you know, in larger cities, and we saw architecture, we saw countrysides. I remember we were driving through Switzerland, I think, and I looked in the field and I just saw fields and fields of farmland, and I think I saw wild cats, just not wild cats but stray cats, well, farm cats, whatever, just hopping through the fields, just jumping. I don't know why that image stuck with me, but stuff like that, just looking out the window,
so enchanted. Also, it's so enchanted.
Yeah, I was, man, and I wasn't driving. We had So that's the other cool thing about touring in Europe. When we're in the United States, we're not. When we're in Europe, the booking agent, actually Tito, drives us, at least for probably 60% of the tour.
Yeah, Tito is a piece of work. Also,
well, he loves that. Like, as much as I hate driving, he loves driving.
Yeah, well, that's also because France has like this welfare system where if you're working in the music industry, and you,
right, you got to get his hours in, and he gets some supplementary income for that.
Yeah, so he get, like, even though we're not paying him as our driver, that he gets a check from the government for like, oh, you went to this many shows, worked at this many shows, drove this many miles, we're going to give you, you know, whatever, $1,000 a month. Like, that shit's crazy. I wish we had that shit out here.
No, me too, because then, I still hate driving. What am I talking about? But that's the thing. He actually, Tito loves driving. He loves, we go to a gas station, he's happy as shit. We go to a rest stop, he's happy. We go to a you know, those little weird houses that they put us up in different European countries. He loves it.
He knows the shadiest places in every city to pull off and get some decent hash. It's one thing I respect about our booking agent.
Oh yeah, those were some uncomfortable moments.
Where people are, like, looking at the car, wondering if we're caught. Didn't, like, somebody think we were CIA or something?
Yeah, I think that was around Paris. No, it was around, what's that other, the second largest city in France? What was that?
Lyon?
No, is that the second largest? Maybe I'm wrong. It was a really large city. It starts with an M.
Marseille?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think we were there, and we pulled up to, like, some apartment complexes. And yeah, everyone starts screaming at us because they thought we were police. I'm like, I don't know. American tourists look like police. But then there was some other time he took us to this, I think it was Paris. We drove up this hill and he just parked. Oh, I come right back, don't worry. And we just get, it's dark. And suddenly our car is surrounded by kids, just surrounded. And I'm like, man, don't talk to me. I think you rolled the window down. You're like, what's up? Oh, what do you need to? I think the American accent threw them off, and then they left us alone. But it was weird. And then he gets back in the car an hour and a half later with a big ass smile on his face. Like, come on, man.
I love how we were like, yo, Pain One doesn't smoke. You know, dude's like real, you know, on his shit about his health. So like, no smoking tobacco in the car. That's our only request, and like
the car that became a cigarette.
That didn't even register. We were like, yo, man, roll the window down. Oh, it just rolled down. Like, no, man, like, actually roll it down and throw the fucking cigarette out, motherfucker. I'm like, what the fuck, man? It's crazy.
Yeah, like, I'd have my window up, and then all of a sudden cigarette ash would just swing over and hit me in the face while I'm trying to sleep in the backseat.
That's awesome. Yeah, like, for me, my favorite things are, like, I mean, it's the same thing as, like, going to Europe for some, but experiencing something new, you know, like, every time we go to Athens, it's like, whoa, we're in another fucking world. You know, it feels like we're in a different century or something. Like,
Athens was amazing.
Yeah, and, like, you know, like the in the like the people we know there are like inspiring, and that's what I like. I like meeting people who are like, you know, engaged in cool, inspiring projects. Like, you know, I think we're like the only rappers who've been to Tarnak, and we've been there twice, and like that's this, you know, commune, not even a commune, but this cool community.
Yeah, they don't call it that.
It's a cool community in like the mountains of France. And like, you know, like in America, until then I never really thought of radicals, like revolutionary minded people having acres and acres of farmland and integrating that into their projects. Like that was like life changing for me. Like to see that, be like, oh, these motherfuckers are about their shit, and they're growing herb spirals and all this like permaculture shit, and medicine gardens, and like. It's just cool. It's you know, I would never have seen any of that shit without music. You know, who can afford to just gallivant around the world like that? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, you gotta appreciate that when you think about it that way. I have those moments.
I mean, like, you know, obviously, it's really easy to complain. Like, I've definitely been, as I've been trying to tour less, thinking, like, like it's just not how I want to spend my life, like in cars and having to get fucked up to, like, you know, survive the whole experience. But you know, I think there's like a happy medium there. But all right, what's the worst? What are like some? Because you have a much better. I block all this shit, like because I smoke weed or whatever. So I manage to like block the worst memories and just remember like the best meals we ate or whatever food tour. But
what was the best meal we ate on tour? That's a hell of a question.
Well, I'll say this: one of the best. Because you mentioned Marseille, I was thinking of that restaurant we went to. Even though I didn't really like the food there, I thought the ambiance in that restaurant in Marseille was fucking awesome. Like, they have these giant candles all over the place, and like they just let the candles melt in place, and then they just kept putting more and more candles, and so you had like 10 years of molten candle wax as like. And that, I thought that was a cool aesthetic. But I don't know. I'll think about that for 1 second. What do you think is the best meal we ate on tour?
I remember liking that, but I remember some bad things about that experience. Well, they think the French people gave you meat and told you it was a potato or something. But, the worst experience was when we stayed at that meth lab motel and, New Mexico. Where were we? That was a rough night. And I think it was only rough because all the elements came together to create a really awful experience. We had driven, I think, 8 hours to the venue, and then we had to drive another 10 because we were, you know, we're at the Texan New Mexico area, so everything is far away. And so we were just already exhausted and psychologically just drained. And then we play this event where the promoter is just, I don't know what's up with this guy, but he's telling us how hard he's been trying lately, but failing. Just kind of just setting the scene for disappointment. I'm like, all right, man, okay, stop talking right now, please. But yeah, no, dude, it's just, you know, I hit up everybody here, look at my text, check out my text, no one wants to come, no one wants to come out to shows anymore, what's going on? I don't know, man, I'm trying. Like, yo, dude, chill, you're actually giving us anxiety. If only 5 people show up to this event, cool, we find out when those 5 people show up, but stop talking to us about this. And, only 5 people did show up, and then he lied about our booking agreement, and, it was rough, and then we got to stay in a motel that didn't have any door handles on it because too many meth labs were I don't, something weird, something having to do with drug dealing and whatever. Once we showed up to the motel, the police were already there, and some incident had just wrapped up, and they were waiting on the next one. That was a rough night. It was rough too.
That was awful. We drove like 14 or 16 hours that day. Yeah. Like, we killed ourselves to get there, and if we didn't have a guarantee, we wouldn't have driven that far. We would have, like, done a leisurely drive, we would have gotten a hotel somewhere nice in between there and probably spent some time hiking and, like, doing some healthy adventures. And I think that that adds to it because, like, the Southwest is so beautiful. Like, you don't want to just fly through it. Like, you want to...
Right.
You know, you want to get out and look at some. So, okay, you're asking me what my best meal was. I don't know if it was best, but, like, shit that, like, affected me was, like, the that 48-hour stew that we had in...
Yeah.
I don't even
remember. The south of France. It was some southern area. Yeah, because it was beautiful because there was the ocean and you could just feel it. We couldn't see it from where we were eating, but we felt it. Yeah, and then we ate. And they made it vegan, I remember.
So, just for listeners, like, basically it's a French style of making soup where, you know, you have your fall vegetables, like big chunks of potatoes, big chunks of carrots, big chunks of zucchini, and lots of tomatoes, the beans or whatever, and you just, with lots of red wine, and you just slow cook it for 48 hours. And you can also do it for 24 hours. But, like, I guess I never really ate soup made with red wine. And I've made that meal so many times since then. Like, it's such, like, a subtly, like, vegan French cooking actually is never anything I would have sought out. But, like, learning that, learning about, like, blanquette, which is, like, a Dijon mustard stew, it's fucking, like, we didn't have that on our travels. That's fucking nothing. I mean, who would think of making a creamy Dijon mustard stew? Like, it's so good. So fucking good.
Yeah, I think that was my favorite region to tour.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's so cool. Yeah, and I think also I've had, like, really... I mean, I've had a lot of good food. Like, have we played Leipzig together? Did we play...
Yeah.
Those motherfuckers do not fuck around at that Zorro restaurant. They that venue, Zorro, they're some of the best vegan chefs. That guy, Alex, is one of the best vegan chefs in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Remind me what that place was like.
That was the one where the guy was upstairs with a British dude, kind of followed us and was, like... kind of fucking weird and wouldn't, like, manage to, like, sneak into the guest room. Remember, it's like a fucking Geiger painting. Like, the downstairs is all industrial with pipes everywhere. It's a squat in Eastern Germany, and it's or Western. I always get those two confused.
Oh, with all the graffiti, yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's real. It's a big room, lots of cigarette smoke, loud system, and then you have the upstairs where it's like all those big wooden tables, and then they just, like, fill it with food for us, and I think we stayed there two nights last time. I think we had, like, a day off there. Yeah, because we went to their restaurant, right? Anyway, Alex is, like, white guy with dreads. You know that dude? Remember that one white guy with dreads?
Yeah. No, because his kid was there, right?
Yeah, probably. Yes.
Yeah, we stayed there a couple days, I remember. Yep.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people were... every time I looked out my window, I saw someone publicly urinating.
Yep. They're free, man. They're free in Germany.
Yeah, yeah, we were out there with what's his name, my man?
Oddity?
Yeah, weren't we there? Because he and I went to some store mad late at night, and he got into a fight with a security guard.
Oh, yeah, because he was staying with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. It's all a blur. Shout out to Oddity. If you don't know Oddity's music, check him out. He's an awesome hip-hop artist from...
in New York.
Yeah.
But he's French now.
Yeah, he's up there. I mean, that one really tops it, man. That was just, like, really low, you know, for me.
Yeah, that was always the Southwest. It's just, we play one really dope show in New Mexico or something, and then all the rest, just, you know, Austin and Houston and Albuquerque, all of those are just miserable. But, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a crazy, crazy incident. Okay, yeah, when I got a tampon thrown at me, that was crazy.
Where was that?
That was in Switzerland. In what's that? It was an anarchist space where we're elevated on that super high up stage, and there's a fire. What is that place? What city
was that? That was Bern, Switzerland.
Yeah, Bern. Yeah, I love playing there. I love that place. But it was that the opening act had a DJ, and I don't speak German, so there were some young women in the crowd that had a problem with what the opening act said in their lyrics. And so when I went up to sound check, I guess they thought I was part of that group, and I wasn't. So I'm getting set up. All of a sudden, I see something fly towards me, and it lands, and it sounds squishy. And I'm like, oh man. So I look over, and it's a tampon that's well used. And in my head, I'm just telling myself, all right, don't react, don't react, don't react. So I just kept on setting up my equipment, and I figured she can only have one. So didn't happen again. And I was just like, damn, I mean, for you to do that, you must have had a hell of a grievance. I'm not getting involved.
Did you ever find out what that was about? Like what the person said that made her want to throw a tampon on stage? Was it like just some sexist shit that some rapper was doing?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I mean, the language barrier... it was weird. I didn't... Because we were in a political space, and there were a lot of... I don't know. Things get lost in translation, because I asked, and they couldn't really explain it, and I don't know. But I don't know. I don't want to comment, because I had no insight. But it was weird for me. I don't think... I wasn't going to... I'm proud that I didn't freak out and make it a situation that I personalized, because it wasn't, and it just, I was collateral damage in that scenario.
It's so funny because I don't remember that at all, you know?
I remember you got on stage and I was just like, hey Tim, man, don't look down, but there's a bloody tampon on my table. You're like, whoa, dude, why? And I'm like, I don't know, man. I think I just wrong place at the wrong time, but we'll just do our show.
Crazy. Yeah, I mean, it was just because my drummer from Soul and the Skywriter band, John, is here visiting. So we were like, you know, doing the drunken tour story thing. And like, it's just always funny what other people remember about those experiences. Because like, you know... You know, they talk about how, like, you know, when you get older, like, it's not that you forget things, like, your brain, you know, like, learns to sort, like, what information that you want to draw, you know, draw on. And just, like, for me, like, I keep the food and the politics and, like, you know, things that are, like, deeply inspiring, and then all the other stuff, I just edit it all out, I guess. Mm. I would think that I would remember the tampon flying, though, because that's like, you know, you always want to be careful.
Well, you weren't on stage when it flew, so I'm happy you weren't, because that you just would have been another target.
Yeah.
Maybe you would have blocked it, though.
Yeah, maybe, or maybe I would have, it would have hit me, you know, would have hit me and...
landed in your hood.
Yeah, and then I could... You know, ask why is this being thrown at me? What have I done?
Then this would be your story.
Right. Instead, it's yours.
Yeah.
All right, so there's a couple other points of conversation we had on this little list that we talked about earlier. So, you know, you work with everyone. You know, you're a musician by trade, a producer, and an educator. So you work with people like whatever, you know, whoever it is. That, like, who is it this quarter? It's Wiz Khalifa, Logic?
No, I wasn't involved in Logic, but close friends were, so but congratulations.
But the Wiz Khalifa, like, you know, you're always doing shit with these people who definitely are not, like, feminists in the same way that you are.
Sure.
To put it mildly. And,
I don't know if anyone's thrown a tampon at Wiz Khalifa.
Right. Right. Well, you never know. Probably. He's played some pretty big shows. But it's a lot. It's a lot of money to spend to just throw a tampon at someone. Also.
Yeah, I think our event was donation only.
But you know, so like, I'm curious, like, what, you know, what is your, like, do you get feedback from people about, like, the politics of our music, or do you have, like, what's your relationship to the, like, the political content in our music?
I mean, I get feedback just from my tweets and my YouTube comments. Some people really freak out. I think some people are happy to find out what my politics are, but every now and then, someone wrote me an essay the other day of why they were unsubscribing from my YouTube. I didn't really read it, but it had to do with politics. So, you know, I miss that person sorely, and I hope it never happens again. But I think you've had more pushback. I've never had. I don't know, man. Maybe it's different because I'm a producer and people aren't hearing me speak all the time. But it seems like some people were disillusioned once they found out that you were a leftist.
Right, totally. Like,
whereas with me, it was like, I don't know, I just existed in a different space. And maybe I'm just lucky. Maybe most of the people that support me, I get into arguments with people, but I think the most political argument I had over the last week was about Illuminati, where people were like, well, you explain Lady Gaga's hand symbol. And I'm like, all right, that's not really political. That's why I don't even like those conversations. But, you know, there are blowouts every now and then. When the InfoWars guy retweets me, then there's a blowout on my Twitter, but that has nothing to do with my music community. But with you, you know, like I check out, if we upload a music video or something on YouTube, write the comments, man, I wish this guy never become some fucking anarchist living at home with his mom. I was like, what did you expect Soul to become when you heard, you know, Bottle of Humans? Like, the natural evolution of Bottle of Human Soul was clearly to become, you know, Ben Shapiro's grandfather. I don't know.
Totally. Or like, you know, when, you know, to be screaming, you know, the white man's the fucking devil, you know, before people even know what white privilege is, you know, for a lot of listeners, like, what, you know, I mean, really, before I even, like, had that kind of analysis around.
Well, let me ask you that, because, yeah, that was, when I heard that, and that's, Selling Like Water is one of my favorite albums of all time, but when I heard that, I'm like, is he being sarcastic? He doesn't sound sarcastic. And how did your fans take that? Where did they see it as a political statement, or did it just kind of get thrown into the bucket of abstract hip hop?
Well, I think people took it as a political statement, but it's more of like I think people like resonate with being at that moment. They resonated with like being a white person listening to growing up on hip hop that was like black nationalist, and hearing about, you know, you're the, you know, all the fucked up shit white people have done, but then like, you know, sort of just like owning it and, you know, saying, yeah, fucking white people suck. And I have to ask people what that phrase means to them, you know, because I know people always saying that shit along. Yeah. Because, and then it also goes into talking about like, fuck a job, you know, fuck a corporation. The only thing you do from your job is steal from your boss. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I remember I'd be like weary about performing that. You know, like, God, is someone gonna punch me in the face for admitting I wanted to be black at age 14? Like, but no, people. I think there's a lot of white people who, you know, felt that way in the 90s. If you were growing up listening to hip-hop, you know, thinking like, oh, I'm white. I remember getting in an argument with my dad about it. He's like, you don't want to be black. I'm like, Dad, we don't have a culture. White people don't have a culture. You know, he's like, you're fucking crazy, kid. You don't know what you're talking about. All right, well, if pizza and... Then I realized, yeah, we do have a culture. It's like pizza and Star Wars and...
Yeah, true. Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, lobster boats, you know. I come from a line of fishermen, you know. That's my culture. And, you know, for better or for worse, that's what I come from. So, but it takes a long time to learn that stuff. And yeah, I don't understand the YouTube comment shit. Like, I actually don't ever go on YouTube. I actually, like, really neglect YouTube. When I go on there, I'm just like, who are these people just posting negative shit on YouTube every day? Like I just don't...
Who are these people? They're YouTube, man. If you were on YouTube more, you would understand that that's the culture.
It's so crazy, though. It's like, it's like, I use YouTube. I use YouTube to, like, watch all kinds of shit all the time. Like, they have, like, sitting there, like, fingertips on the keyboard watching YouTube videos and just, like, commenting on them and talking shit. It's just like, it just seems like such a weird way to spend your time. I don't get it.
Yeah, that's something I've learned. The more I've traveled, people find weird pastimes.
But yeah, it's like, so, you know, I'd be curious how you feel about this. Like, you're someone who, you know, you started off as a producer, and now you're kind of like, you know, you're a producer, but you're also like this mentor, helping young artists and established people, like, understand how to use social media and all these platforms to reach people. And, like, I've been thinking lately about how it's just like, When I imagined what my music career would be like, I imagined it like being a warehouse with records in it, and like we'd have like these heated industry conversations and like sending our records out to people, but it was mostly like politicking and like talking to people. And now it's almost like you can put out records without ever having to talk to another human being just by learning how to like run ads and create content and, you know, game these algorithms. Like, what do you think about that, man? Like, does that bother you?
It stopped bothering me, but it definitely isn't what I thought it would be. I don't think anyone imagined, well, maybe some people, but nah, hell no. I thought I was going to be performing and touring and just making music, and it was all musical. But I had a rude awakening. Yeah, man. I never wanted to be an ad strategist or a online marketer or whatever the people on the YouTube ads call themselves. And here I am. But it's afforded me a whole lot of control, and that's a benefit. It's also one of the most precarious things in the world, because as we were talking about earlier, changes all the time, and it's all third party. You know, you can't trust Facebook, you can't trust Google not to change on a dime, and suddenly the interests of the independent unsigned artist or small business owner are still going to be central to that change. It's never going to happen. So, you know, we fall into a rhythm, and then something changes, and we scatter like ants, and then we reconvene and figure it out, and it just happens again and again, and just makes you wonder what the future holds.
Well, it's funny you said that. I mean, I don't know if you've really looked into this new cryptocurrency that Facebook is rolling out, but this shit, like, you know, where they, like, killed off like pages after the Russiagate stuff, so that you can't just be, right, like, create a page and then run a bunch of ads on it to reach people with that page. And so, like, for me, I've been building up my Facebook page for 10 years, and now it's pretty much useless, and now they want me to create a group. And I was like, why the fuck would I create another, invest another minute into this platform after what you just did to me? Like, nope, not gonna do it. And I was like, why would they even do that? Like, is this just increased engagement with each other? Like, creating these communities? They want you to create communities. And then when I saw the way they were rolling out their cryptocurrency, that Facebook is gonna drop a cryptocurrency next year with other players like PayPal, Uber, Airbnb. I mean, it's like, it's the gig economy, you know, fucking times 10. And, like, you know, I was tripping off Elizabeth Warren, you know, was talking about how we need to nationalize Facebook. And it's like, that seems pretty fucking quaint right now. Facebook is 2 billion people, and they're talking about, like, now I understand why they're, you know, Facebook is bigger than most countries, right? You have 2 billion people on there. And, like, now that they're, like, trying to build all these communities through there, the idea of rolling out a cryptocurrency down the line is like, yeah, we don't need your artist page ad revenue anymore. We're done with you. We're done with that whole model. Now we're going to become a government. We're going to become our own economy. And so, you know what? Your states are most likely going to collapse, and you're going to be living in this globalized ANCAP Facebook governed world in 30 years. You know, it's great. I mean, like, that's not a conspiracy theory. You know, that's like, as the states begin to crumble, I could really see, like, this play Facebook is making for, like, a cryptocurrency. Like, if that works out, if that doesn't get stopped, like, right, that, the fucking impact that that would have, I can't even imagine that. I mean, that's crazy. That's just crazy.
I think it would be an easy move for them, too. I don't see much stopping them.
I mean, but do you agree that that's like, I mean, that's earth shattering. You know what I mean? Like, these senators are over here. Like, I don't know if you ever listened to, like, the Senate hearings on, like, technology. Like, they don't even understand.
No, they don't get it. No, they don't
know how Twitter works.
Yeah.
And these people are supposed to legislate a cryptocurrency that's being used by 2 billion people.
That's, I don't know, man. I didn't know about the cryptocurrency, so I'm still processing this, but definitely changes things and beyond just the way that we optimize our ads, far beyond that.
But the thing about Facebook, over here, I'm reading Wall Street Journal. Facebook Libra is a license to print money. And, like, what they're going to do is, like, unlike cryptocurrencies, like, all the Facebook coin is going to be backed by real money.
Oh, gosh. All right.
It's fucking crazy. I mean, that shit's crazy. And so I think, like, that in itself was what made me rethink whether or not we should include that Big Data song on the album. Because, like, we should talk about that, I guess, off this call, but, it's like, I feel like, that shit's insane. That shit's fucking crazy. Yeah, I mean, like, the way they're rolling it out is insane, and...
I need to look this up. This is the first time I'm hearing about it, so I'm kind of taken aback.
A bunch of big companies have agreed to pony up $10 million each to take part. And so that will make them, like, shareholders. And so they'll have their own, like, privately held, you know, Federal Reserve kind of situation. And, yeah, it'll be the biggest. It'll go from, like, being, like, a big platform global to the biggest global economy. It's insane. Yeah, so, I don't know, man. What else about this album? What is there anything that, like, strikes you as different about this album musically or thematically than our other records?
I think musically, at least from my perspective, because I'm the one, you know, composing all the music. It's a lot clearer. I think Death Drive was definitely more heavily produced than, well, let me rephrase that. I think with Death Drive, I spent a lot of time on the production, and I think that was during my still kind of overthinking music phase of life. And this new one just kind of happened more naturally. Not that Death Drive wasn't natural, but just the process of reaching a point of completion that we could agree on, because the song's never really done. But just getting the song done to a point where we liked it, that happened a lot more smoothly this time. And, you know, we don't have any real features. I mean, Ted Park and Caleb, sorry, but his Decomposer. Yeah, they're the only other guys on the album, except we have Hang Drum in one of the tracks from this guy named Slow-Mo from out here. That's different, actually. That's weird. We have Hang Drum.
That's live?
Yeah, that's all live.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was crazy to record. It took a lot of troubleshooting, because the thing looks like a UFO. It looks like a UFO or a walk. And just to have that in, you know, how small my studio is, just to have that there and then trying to mic it and then trying to incorporate that into a beat, that was a hell of an experience. But hey, we did it. And then, you know, obviously Memories on it, playing guitar. So we're kind of maintaining the core Solon DJ Payne 1 sound, but it's definitely changing. It's not, I don't think we've ever been stuck in some kind of stylistic or sonic rut over the course of the last, we're calling this our third album, but it's our third album. We have two other EPs, so it's kind of like our fifth.
Yeah, and if we also collected all the loose tracks from Nihilismo, you know, that's an EP too. But yeah, I don't know, for me, it's like when we started working together, I was just like, oh, I want club, you know, beats. I want trap beats. I know you hate that term, but I was like, I want these trappy, like, whatever, kind of drums and beats, and like, that's the shit I want to rap on. And like, that shit got deaded really quick, you know, because you're sending such a wide variety of like variations on that stuff, and then like eventually like our sonic palette just keeps spreading out, where like on this album I feel like songs like The World, like the world ain't mine, the world ain't yours, it's fucking gone, let's start anew, like that track reminds me of you know, like Pharaoh Monch, Get the Fuck Up, you know. And then you got tracks on there like Fuck the Law, which is like a straight up Solon DJ Payne 1, you know, anthem, you know.
Yeah.
But then you got tracks like, you know, Wrong Side, a lot, like there's some real New York sounding shit on this record, and that's what kind of gets me pumped to like get into those styles a little bit more, and like that approach, like more East Coast stuff. And then it's like, yeah, I mean, the drums are always gonna like bump in the club, but like sonically, like there's, I feel like there's more emo shit on this record, like not like quote unquote emo, like shit that has like a more reflective, like spacey kind of emotional arc to some of the shit. Like I'm thinking of like the song I am not whatever I said, I'm not meant for this place, always weary, that song, where in the I was not made for, wait, no, I was not meant for this place. That one, and then the Rocks in Space song, like, I don't know, it's just like I'm really happy with the track listing that we ended up with. Like, all the songs that didn't make it, I think, are actually really good as well, but like, I like that we chose, that we made enough like standalone, standout tracks that are like, in my opinion, different than other stuff we've done. We have some stuff that, like, you know, touches on some stuff that, like, is consistent for us, but, like, there's enough variation there that I think it makes it, like, a really fun record.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of these tracks are standalone. I think that's just a product of us working so much on individual songs over a period of time rather than a body of work all at once.
Yeah, because you get to live in one song for like 2 months, and then it's like, okay, yeah, this one's cool. This one's cool. And then it's like, this one's okay. You know, this one's not going to go on the album. This one's not going to get finished. So, yeah, and I think that's what, it's like, it seems like 2.5 years on an album feels like a decade in 2019. You know, you're supposed to make an album in like 3 weeks.
Those 2.5 years flew by, though. I blinked, and it's 2.5 years later.
You're telling me I got my... this 2-year-old kid running around.
Yeah.
He's fucking... he's all about tadpoles right now. So we just go down to the pond, scoop out some tadpoles, and he just goes nuts, man. It's fucking... being a dad is the best, though. I mean, I know I was talking about in the beginning, like, how I don't get as much done. Quite honestly, I don't care. Like, I think raising a kid is, you know, some of the most meaningful work I've gotten to do, and highly recommend it. I wish I hadn't waited so long, but, you know, fuck it, right? Gotta outbreed our enemies, man.
Yeah, that is a strategy I've heard.
It's definitely one the left is losing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. People, please, if you're listening to this album, you dig our music, you want to support it, you know, consider making a pre-order, backing us on Kickstarter. We still have about, I don't know, a little under $6,000 to raise before the record's funded. It'll be funded, you know, around like the second week of July. It closes out, so, you know, we can
celebrate America's independence by funding our project.
Then keeping Soul and DJ Pain 1 listener supported and 100% independent.
That, you know what? I like that term better than independent, because what does independent even mean anymore? Listener supported is more descriptive.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. As opposed to like, you know,
we're indie, we're unsigned, like that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, plus it, like, you know, makes it sound more like NPR, which is
right. Yeah, our fan base is, you know, they're not 17 anymore.
You know, since you know so much about like the way things are changing and the way media works, do you have any tips or any advice for like whatever content creators out there who want to use the internet to reach people, whether it's journalists or musicians or activists? Like, do you have any tips before we go to the beach?
Yeah, data ownership. So, with all this talk about Facebook and various other platforms changing their algorithms, changing their policies, reducing your reach to the people that you need to reach, scares the hell out of you, but at the same time, it's kind of an impetus to take more control over those data. And you got to kind of think about, I mean, worst case scenario with social media, you wake up and it's gone. And if it's gone, does your connection with the people that you've reached on those social media go with it? And if the answer is yes, then that's a problem, right? That means you have no data ownership, and there's some humongous company that doesn't care about you standing in between you and your supporters, or you and your colleagues and comrades and so forth. So finding ways to control and own and possess that data in a way where you can use it when you need to is really the new way to truly find independence. You know, we're independent artists, but we're using Facebook. We're independent artists, but we're using YouTube. YouTube and Facebook, they don't give us contact information for our subscribers or our followers. We have to find a way to get that. And that this circles back to our album. It's listener supported. How can it be listener supported if we can't directly reach our listeners and they can't directly reach us? Doesn't make sense, right? That's why the whole independent, unsigned phrases, whatever you want to call it. That's why the independent and unsigned labels don't really mean much now, because how independent can you be when one of the biggest companies in the world owns all of your data? So be wary of that. Whether you're an artist, whether you're an activist, all of those worlds are people-centered. So you have to make sure that you can contact the people and they can contact you.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, it reminds me, like, shout out to Bandcamp. Like, if you've ever bought my music or our music on Bandcamp, we have your email address and you've been added to the Soul newsletter. And, you know, I've been using that email list for 15 years. It's my number one way to reach people. And so when Facebook changed their algorithms and I just basically stopped using it, it hit me in the gut. Actually, I just, instead of paying Facebook $100 a month to advertise, I just stopped doing that and just started sending out emails more, like, you know, every 2 weeks or every month as opposed to every couple months. And that, and just being able to directly communicate with my base is great. And the only downside to that is that at the end of the day, Google can filter your emails and put them in spam, and, you know, there's other layers to it, but at least if you have email addresses and contact info, I do think that's important, especially for anarchists and radicals and leftists. Like, the internet no longer wants us using it the way that we've been using it, so we have to get smart. You know, like the way that we used to organize stuff, like blockades and all these sorts of things, the Twitter hashtags, like, they don't want that shit happening anymore through those platforms. You know, the way people used to organize through Facebook, like, they don't want that shit anymore. So we have to get started. Well, I like to end every interview or every conversation with, books. So I don't know if you've been reading anything, if you recommend any books. Like, right now I'm reading this book called The Intelligent Gardener, and it's all about, like, soil health and body health and, like, creating nutritious vegetables. And, like, what's interesting about it is, like, they talk about how, like, if the ground is really wet, that it doesn't necessarily have the ability to, like, store nutrients. And so if you're getting vegetables in a lot of places, like on the East Coast, like, your vegetables are likely devoid of nutrients. So even if things are grown organically, like, if it's not, like, supplemented with, like, mineral dust and volcanic ash, like, there's a likelihood that you're not getting your nutritional, you know, the nutrients that you need. And it was, like, based on, like, homesteaders who, like, they've been eating organic grown food, but, like, their teeth were falling out later in life, and they're like, what the fuck's going on here? Like, how did we fuck this up? And then they're like, oh, your soil. So, shout out to soil health. That's my, that's what I'm geeking out on. Where are you at, man?
I'm reading a lot of manuals for the stuff at my house, and then I'm also, for whatever reason, reading Don Quixote right now. Why not?
Is it good?
Yeah, I know, my answers suck. I try to go back and read classics that I didn't read back when I was an anti-intellectual teen.
Tilting at windmills, man.
Yeah.
What manuals are you reading, like, for dishwashers and shit?
For heating coils and stuff, because I had ice dams that damaged my ceiling over the winter. And I know that the winter is, you know, people are like, oh, well, just an unseasonably rough winter. Like, nah, man, this is it's just gonna keep happening. This is how the world is now. So I guess if I can't stop global warming, I can stop ice dams. It's where the water collects and doesn't have a place to escape on your roof. So it's literally just a dam formed out of ice, and then it pushes it under your shingles, and then it infiltrates your house.
Oh, God.
Yeah, man.
And that's what you had to deal with your first year as a homeowner, was that?
My first 2 months as a homeowner, that's what I had to deal with.
That's fucked, man. Well, at least you had a roof. Yeah, just crazy, man. That shit's like... I know, it's like... it's in some ways, I felt like that was like a weird detail to put in our Kickstarters. Because it's like... it doesn't mean we're balling. It just means we're broke in a different way. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
But it's like, to me, I think it's important. Like I still like think homeownership is a good idea. Like, at least you have something that you can do whatever you want with it. And it's harder to take away. I don't know.
I mean, if anyone wants to take away my house right now, just send me an email.
Oh, shit. All right, well, we're going to the beach, man. So, I'm out of here. So, thank you, Pain Wine, for spending your early Sunday recording this amazing podcast. And
anytime. Well, maybe not anytime.
Any last really. Words? Any last words?
I was just up late, man. I was working. Last words. It's all a lie. It's all a lie.
I'm an extremist, cause the place more vacuum want to form a life. This is my home, not a motherfucking resource. They say I'm an extremist. My grandfather went to France to fight the Nazis, and we're supposed to sit around for 4 years. Well, there was a Nazi in the Oval Office. Nah. They said bend the knee, I say my back is sore. They told me get a job, I already got 4. They tell me I'm white, but I wasn't before. Bacon's rebellion pit us against one another. But hey, nothing sacred, not even the economy. We think cash rules, it's all ideology. I mean, Michigan drinking water still toxic. Well, castaways, 3% killers still walking. We spent $700 a month on health insurance, but when we had a kid, it's 10 G's out the pocket. And that's some real WTF, real talk. 2 years later, we still paying that off. But hey, I owe some land, I ain't got no college debt. That's more than I can say than a lot of folks I've met. But we split hairs, they go split atoms. Where I stand light years to the left of Rachel Maddow. Anarchists like Orwell, communists are no committee. We defend our neighborhoods, they bomb cities. On J20, some windows got smashed. Cops got what they had coming. Mass arrested everyone and tried to give them life in prison. From the comfort of your limo, you called them extremists. But we're living in a nightmare. Sometimes it feels they're the only ones dreaming. I'd rather hug a tree than a motherfucking cop. Place more faith in a seed than a motherfucking bank. We don't need economy, but you say it's sacrosanct. Bitch, more value in a data set than a human life. Don't compare us with the white supremacists who shoot schools. Cause when the hurricane hits, we'll be there with some food. And when you go on strike, we'll be there standing with you. And if you never see the light, we'll be making candles too.